Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Jean-Pierre Changeau. And to most of you, it's not necessary to introduce him to you because he's really no stranger to UCSD. And he's been a visiting professor here for three years. Previous to that, he has been come here for various seminars and types of meetings in San Diego, and he has had impact across our university campus. And not only with respect to pharmacology and the neurosciences, but he has uncovered many colleagues that relate to other departments as well. And to name a few, bioengineering, anthropology, literature, music, and history have all had, in one way or another, a French connection. And Jean-Pierre has actually brought out some of these people that we never knew over in pharmacology that are part of this. And indeed, Jean-Pierre's career starts a long time ago. And often when he's introduced to a student will say, yes, I read your father's work in 1964 and 1965 on the Minot-Wyman-Changeau hypothesis. But in fact, that was related to his graduate work with Jacques Minot before he came to UC Berkeley as a postdoctoral fellow with Howard Schachman, and then returned to a faculty position at the Pasteur Institute. He's received many honors across the country in terms of honorary degrees in Europe and in the United States. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, our National Academy of Sciences, our Institute of Medicine, and has many honorary degrees as well. And I think a remarkable element of Jean-Pierre's endeavors relate to the cross-disciplinary activities in many different fields. And in a way, it's a true renaissance type of activity where, indeed, his scholarly activity impacts on many different areas. And I'm particularly pleased to have this seminar and session sponsored by the Skaggs Family Foundation, who has been very interested in connecting art and science at UCSD in their support of the Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences, and the French Attaché for Science and Technology in Los Angeles. And Mireille Guidel will come up and just say a word because it's been both of those groups that have sponsored Jean-Pierre's lecture.
Good evening. It is my great pleasure to be with you today to listen to Professor Jean-Pierre Changeau, one of our best scientists, most brilliant mind in French science, and a pioneer in the field of neurology. The Office for Science and Technology is really an honor to support this conference, which is a wonderful display of cooperation and open-mindedness in many regards. I would like to particularly thank Professor Changeau for accepting to give this talk, and Professor Palmer Taylor for co-sponsoring this event and for organizing it. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I may say I am delighted to be here with you again. Thanks to Professor Palmer Taylor, who invited me to deliver this talk and who has been hosting me during the past 3 years in his extremely active laboratory. And I may say I'm delighted to be there these past years, and I hope to maintain the contact in the future years. And I think for me it is an exceptional opportunity to have a network of, I would say, positive cooperative interactions between the American laboratories and the French laboratories, and to try to have joint work together in the field of pharmacy, pharmacology, and the neuroscience, and even, say, biochemistry in general. I'm therefore extremely pleased to give this lecture. And I want to thank also, of course, the SCAG Fabinet Foundation, who has been supporting my stay here, and also the French Embassy and Mireille Guyader, who has kindly accepted to cooperate in the organization of this lecture. Now, you may ask the question, why this lecture, being a neuroscientist and molecular biologist? And I think the reason is that a few years ago, I organized an exhibition in Nancy in 2005, which was entitled La Lumière au siècle des Lumières, which means in English, from the physics of light and visual perception toward a new conception of the world. And the motivation was to celebrate a year in Nancy, 2005, the Age of Enlightenment. And this was to celebrate the building of the Place Stanislas, which was built in the 1750s by Stanislas Leszczynski, exiled king of Poland, and which is part of UNESCO World Heritage List. And I was asked by the mayor of Nancy, being a scientist and interested in art, to try to illustrate what has been the age of enlightenment in France, in Europe, and I must say in the world. So what is the age of enlightenment? It's typically known as the age of rationalism, and traces its origin to Descartes' Discourse on the Method in 1637, but starts really with the publication of Isaac Newton's Principia Mathematica in 1687 and ends, unfortunately, with Napoleon's Wars in 1804. And the general theme of this exhibition was to try to see to what extent the general application of the principles and methods of science and reason to all natural phenomena and especially to human society have led at the end of the 18th century to freedom, democracy, and fraternity as a primary value of society. And these reasoning and these debates elicited by the philosophers, scientists, and political leaders at that time led to the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the United States Constitution in 1787, and culminated with the Bill of Rights in 1789-1791 and the Declaration of the Rights of Man in 1789 in France. So you may ask the question, why, as a scientist, I was feeling concerned by this issue? And the question is the following. It is a rather important philosophical question, and I may say that I was especially interested in it since I was chairman of the French Bioethics Commission for 6 years. How the scientific method of Newton led to the emergence of ethical values of the Declaration of Independence and of the Declaration of the Rights of Man. Usually one says, well, science has to follow ethical rules. And here I take the opposite move, how at that time the evolution of ideas went in the opposite direction. And the question is how art contributed to the diffusion of these ideas. And I will try to show and to illustrate through this presentation using a few pictures from the whole exhibition, where there were about 250 or 300 items which were presented, only a few of them, to try to illustrate how one can move from indeed Isaac Newton ideas on science to these ethical values of the Declaration of the Rights of Man. Now, this is, of course, an uncharted path, and I may mention only a few interesting personalities, and I'm sure the historians who may be present here will find my approach a little bit simple and reductionist, yet perhaps we may follow some of these personalities and try to see how they were led to this kind of evolution. The outline of my lecture is the following. I will start with Newton, of course, and in France, a woman. And there, as you shall see, women have been very important in this historical evolution. Grabériel, Émilie du Châtelet, and Voltaire. Then I will discuss the eye and the brain at the time of Enlightenment in the 18th century, what we knew at that time, and then go from this knowledge on the neuroscience at that time to Diderot, a letter on the blind, and debate the issue of perceptual judgment from the discussion he offers to us of the born blind and the Molyneux problem. I will come back on that. Now I will continue with a very interesting moment, the voyage of Bougainville and the Diderot supplement to the voyage of Bougainville, which lead us to have thinkings and debates about moral judgment. And I will conclude with two figures of the French and American Enlightenment, Benjamin Franklin, and that you certainly know, and Henri Grégoire, who is a very interesting figures of French Revolution. Now, we may start with Newton and Gabriel-Émilie du Châtelet. Isaac Newton, everybody knows that he's a physicist, mathematician, astronomer, but also a natural philosopher, alchemist, you may not know, and theologian, which is also quite surprising. Now, Newton develops infinitesimal calculus in 1666, and in 1687 publishes a very important book entitled Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, which is the groundwork for classical mechanics with law of universal gravitation and the three laws of motion. Now he shows in this book, I am summarizing in three lines, that the motions of objects on Earth and of celestial bodies, that's the important aspect, are governed by the same natural laws. And thus he removed the last doubt about heliocentrism, but also introduced an important piece of philosophy, that objective description, if possible in mathematical terms, of body motion on Earth and in the universe are based on the same rules. And this is a presentation of the original version of the book of Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, which had important success, of course, in England. Now, one may say that after a few years of very creative scientific work, then Newton went into, as I said, alchemy and theology. But for some scientists who are concerned by the end of life of Newton, one may say that in his body were found massive amounts of mercury, and which was in fact resulting from his alchemical work. And this might, and this is not necessarily my interpretation, but this is mentioned as being one way to explain Newton's eccentricity in late life. But what is important is not Newton's life, it's Newton's work and ideas. And the important thing is that Newton's scientific work crossed the English Channel, and this is a mortuary mask of Newton, and were introduced in France by a scientist who was a rather universal scientist. He has been altogether a mathematician, physicist, astronomer, a biologist concerned by genetics. He was with the Venus physics, one of the first to understand the importance of genetics in determining character in humans. And he visited Newton in 1728 and make a trip to Lapland to try to confirm Newton's views. And he did. Then he came back to France and became professor of geometry of a very distinguished lady, Gabrielle Émilie du Châtelet, who was living in the east of France. And together with Émilie du Châtelet, they began to analyze and debate about Newton Principia Mathematica until a well-known young philosopher came into play, Voltaire, who found, fell in love with Émilie du Châtelet. And together, they wrote about the philosophy of Newton. And on one hand, Voltaire wrote The Elements de la Philosophie de Newton, which was published in 1738, and Gabrielle Émilie du Châtelet herself, The Institution of Physics, in 1740. And I may say that in this dialogue between Émilie du Châtelet and Voltaire, Émilie was a scientist, not Voltaire, of course. And she had a lot of difficulties to make Newton understood by Voltaire, but she did, and I may say that she may have even written several of the chapters that were signed later on by Voltaire himself. But Émilie was a very, very distinguished scientist, and she played a very important role in conveying the ideas of Newton in France, and to start a philosophical debate, not only at the level of scientists, but between scientists and philosophers. And I think this was a key element in the diffusion of Newton's idea in France. As you can see here, this is a very nice portrait of Émilie du Châtelet by a woman artist, Marianne Loire, who gave us a very attractive picture of Émilie. And you can, of course, see here the Planétaire. And this is one of them, which is from the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris and which was presented in the exhibition of Nancy. Now, the ideas of Newton had very important practical consequences, which contributed to the propagation of his views, of his rationalist views about the world. And, for instance, the prediction of eclipses of the sun, and this was from a book of Leonhard Euler, who was a very distinguished mathematician and astronomer in Germany, and also in France, where an important issue was the presence of comets in the sky. And in particular, there was a well-known comet called the Harvey Comet, which was known to return regularly in the sky of France. And using Newton's mathematical views and theories, the astronomer Jérôme Lalande and, you remember the name because I will come back at the very end of my presentation, and again another woman who was one of the most brilliant astronomers of the time, Nicole Reine Hortense Le Pôtre, made the calculation for the time, the precise time for the return of the Harvey Comet. And they calculated that because of the attraction of the planets, there would be a delay in the return of the comet of about 5 and 18 days. And indeed, this what's happened, and the comet did not came back at the time that was predicted in the classical terms, but came back at the time anticipated if the calculation of Newton were correct, and they were correct. So this was, I may say, a public triumph of Newton and mechanics in France, and a strong belief that science had predictable outcomes. And this was, I think, an important step in the diffusion of Newton's idea in France and in Europe in general, in continental Europe, I may say. I just show here a few paintings by Donato Creti, who is from Bologna in 1711, and these paintings are in the Pinacothek of Vatican, from Jupiter, you can see here, from Venus, and here about the moon. Now, there is here also, and it was presented at the exhibition in Nancy, a very interesting clock, which is about 1 meter and a half, or almost 2 meter height. You see, it's a very large scale. It is called the Creation of the World by François Thomas Germain, you can, of course, see the influence of Newton and his views on the king's taste. Here, the sun, the planetary that you can recognize here, the elements, and the whole interesting pattern of this clock, which is directly inspired from science. So there is clearly here a very strong interaction between the knowledge of science at that time and the artisans of the clock, and in particular the great François Thomas Germain. Now, the second aspect of Newton's views is present in the book Optics of 1704. And here he shifts from, let's say, calculation of physical laws in the universe to experimentation. And here in this famous experimentation on the refraction of light, he shows that prism decompose white light into a spectrum of colors. And he further shows that after a lens, a second prism is able to recompose the spectrum into white light. So this was a demonstration that light is heterogeneous and made up of wavelengths of different colors. Now, this led, of course, to conclusion about the color of objects, which are very practical for artists and painters, and that, in fact, the color of objects result from their interaction with already colored light rather than from an intrinsic generation of color by the object themselves, and this is Newton's theory of color. And this second aspect of Newton's thinking is, of course, of extreme importance for the philosophers of the Enlightenment. In fact, it sets forth a natural philosophy in which the primary source of knowledge is experiment and national reasoning, in addition to what I just said of mathematics and the description of physical laws in the universe. So this second aspect, of course, is also fundamental in the importance of rationality in science, and of course had considerable importance in the diffusion of Newton's idea at the time of Enlightenment. These are a few original drawings on the left of his notebook on color and on his book, Optics, in the right. And this was further illustrated by prisms, which were used by scientists to decompose the light, or even by artists. And here it is a beautiful painting of its aquarella by William Turner, Kilcombe Castle with a rainbow. And it is interesting that you don't see much colors in the rainbow by Turner. In fact, the artists were sometimes very critical, sometimes the most critical of scientific ideas. I don't know if this is still the case, but at that time he actually put only three colors, even less than that, instead of the seven of Newton. But in any case, it illustrates how the scientific theories of Newton, which were antagonized by those of Goethe at the same time, may have influenced the art of the time. Now, Newton also had a very remarkable sense of practicality in the sense that he was aware of the decomposition of light by lenses, and that was giving chromatic aberrations. And he developed a telescope without lenses to avoid this aberration, and in fact devised a telescope where only mirrors were used at the objective. So this is again another, and perhaps the last aspect of Newton, which is of importance. This not only had these views on the mathematization of universe, his views on experiments as source of knowledge, but also had insight on the practical application of science to develop instruments to further explore the world. And therefore, he was glorified. And I may quote a verse from Alexander Pope: "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, all was light." And this is another example of the glorification of Newton, with the allegoric monument to Isaac Newton from 1725 by Giambattista Pittoni, who is an Italian painter living in England. And you can recognize, of course, the famous experiment of the decomposition of light, but also a few interesting figures like Pythagoras, Euclid here. You may have not recognized them, but when you look closer to the painting, you realize that they are symbols that let you identify them. Ptolemaeus and even the goddess Athena, for wisdom. So this is an example of how the scientific work of Newton may have inspired the artist. And this is not the only one, since here I show some aquarella by Étienne-Louis Boulet, who was an architect of the time of Enlightenment, which is a project for a cenotaph for Newton. And you can see the size of the cenotaph, since you have here the size of one human being here. You can see the scale, and these are trees. So this is the outside, and then you can go inside with, of course, an effect of night. And also, again, you see the size of a human being here, and the actual tomb of Newton there. And then you have last an effect of day inside with the planetary to illustrate again how Newton was actually inspiring the artists of the time of Enlightenment. Now, let's move to the second part of my presentation, which is the extension of Newtonian approach not only to physics, but to natural sciences. And this is, I think, an important step forward that one may apply to life sciences the same methods as those used by scientists in physics. And, of course, brain anatomy was known since the early Greeks, Herophilus and Erasistratus in Alexandria, who made the first dissections, and it was followed at the Renaissance, of course, by Vesalius, by Leonardo da Vinci, but continued in the 18th century. And this is the lesson of anatomy of Professor Wilhelm Röhl from Cornelius Troost. And the knowledge of the anatomy of the human body became more and more deepened, and also the reproduction of the shows actually the here the description of the muscles, and in particular the muscles of the eye, which are of course of great importance, and even the relationship between the brain and the spinal cord, the brain and the nervous system and the heart. And of course, a very careful description reproduced here in wax from sculptures which are present at the, still stored in the Muséum d'Histoire Naturelle in Paris, which give a rather accurate description of brain convolutions and centers, and even here a dissection of the brain, which shows the difference of organization of the cerebellum, of the cortex, and of course the distinction between white and gray matter, and all this in extraordinary accurate manner. So the knowledge of the anatomy of the brain is becoming increasingly known, and at least at the macroscopic scale. And then biologists came into play, and in particular Buffon, who you may know, the Natural History, published in 1749, which is of course a very important book on the description of living organism and also of several aspects of life. And again, it is interesting to note, for those who did not know that, I discovered it actually, that Buffon himself started his scientific life by translating Newton's method of fluxions and infinite series. And here you can see the credit he gives to Newton in the Histoire Naturelle, and there is clearly an explicit reference to the method of Newton, and here the experiments on gravity. Now, Buffon and his colleagues at that time started to be interested not only in the macroscopic anatomy of the brain, but also in its microscopic anatomy, since the invention of the microscope, and this is a beautiful microscope of the Duc de Chaulnes, with which the components of the human body were investigated. And you can see here one of the first description of the spermatozoon, and here of the nerve fibers by Antonie van Leeuwenhoek, who was actually the first to describe the nerves and using the microscope, and to show that there were not these hollow tubules that Descartes postulated, but were in fact solid elements, cables linking the different centers in the brain and in the nervous system in general. So this was, of course, a first application of Newtonian, I would say, method to biology, and also to experimentation with electricity. There was big debates at that time about the role, respective role of electricity and magnetism. And here, an interesting experiment by Abbé Nollet on electricity of bodies, and here an illustration of the very important book by Luigi Galvani, which described the experiment he did at the end of the 19th century on animal electricity, where he showed that, in fact, animal electricity is identical to the electricity produced by here glass or other physical material. So there is no difference between the electricity produced by animals and by experiment of physics, which is also a very crucial kind of finding. And also that not only that nerves can be stimulated by electricity, but that muscle and nerve may also produce electricity. So this was, if I may say, a very important step in the attempt to understand the brain in physical terms, if I may say. Now, you may be surprised to see this painting by Jean-Siméon Chardin, which was presented in Nancy, but you may recognize here a few interesting vessels. In fact, you have here a pipe for tobacco. You have here a bit of containing most likely alcohol or some alcoholic drink. Then here you have coffee, chocolate, and tea. And you may know that all are brain stimulants. So this was known already at that time, and if I may say, it was the beginning of the pharmacology of the brain, with quite a number of practical applications, since you can see here that these philosophers of the Enlightenment are here debating at the Café Procope that you may still visit, still as it was in the 18th century, almost rue de l'Ancienne Comédie. And you may recognize Voltaire here, Diderot, D'Alembert, Condorcet, who are debating around a table where coffee was used as actually a brain stimulant. So for those who have a bit of humor, we may say that coffee contributed to the as cognitive enhancer to enlightenment. Now, continuing on the extension of Newton's views to biology, here a very nice painting, again by a woman painter, Elisabeth Louise Vigée Lebrun, with a portrait of her daughter and the interest of the artist in optics, in the reflection. And also the interest in anthropology, since you may recognize that this idea to have on the same painting or photograph the profile and the face is has been used by Bertillon at the end of the 19th century to identify, as you know, individuals. So she was, to some extent, ahead of her time in this respect. Now, there is, of course, a beginning of knowledge, at least on the optics of the eye, from Descartes. And at that time, there are several key questions which are raised by physiologists like Lecas in his treatise on sensation and passions about binocular visions. So how can we see one image of the world having two eyes? And this is a question which is raised, for instance, in this chapter, but also the issue of stereopsis. How does it happen that we see the same person here as being identical to itself with different size but at different distance, the size varying with distance, which is the issue of stereopsis, and of course the issue of color vision. So we are approaching key issues of vision, which was raised, but of course at that time not solved as we know today. Now, there was also again a practical application I already mentioned of Newton's view on theory of color and the discovery of trichromy, which is how to get three colors at least on a print, for instance here of a face, using three successive printing of the three basic colors of Newton, red, blue, and yellow. And even though Leblanc was not sharing again the view of Newton's, again as an artist he did antagonize it, nevertheless he was deeply influenced by Newton. Newton in this practical invention of trichromy. Now, the interest of visual aberration and amorphose is illustrated here. And also, these views led to, of course, theories about learning, which are of great importance. Since already at that time, various philosophers, in particular the British philosopher Locke, but also in France Descartes and Condillac, raised the issue of learning. How do we learn about the world, and how do our mental faculties originate? And Condillac was a radical empiricist, like most of the British scientists at that time, and he invented a statue endowed with a single sense, the sense of smell, and then he claimed that this statue would get all the mental faculties of human beings through sensation, through experience, that in fact at birth our mind was a white sheet of paper, and that all which is in our mind originates from experience. And this was for me an argument to illustrate the myth of Pygmalion, who fell in love with a statue he had carved and which was illustrated at that time by several artists. First, I start with a sculpture, Louis-Claude Vassé, who is painted here by Étienne Aubry, and then the sculpture by Falconet of Pygmalion in love with Galatée. And this is a beautiful painting by François Lemoine, which illustrates again the myth of Pygmalion. And last, among other paintings which are presented in Nancy, this nice painting by Suvet, which is supposed to illustrate the invention of the art of drawing, where this lady who is in love of this gentleman is actually trying to get the memory of him through the shade that is circled by the drawing. So this is actually the argument for a rather nice painting. Now, coming to more serious issues, which I already evoked with the question of learning and the issue of how our mind build up or not from experience. I selected a very important moment in the history of philosophy and thinking in French Enlightenment, The Letter on the Blind by Denis Diderot. So Diderot was a French philosopher, chief editor of the Encyclopédie, and he writes this Letter on the Blind in 1749 about precisely how the knowledge we have of the world is acquired, and is it acquired exclusively through perception, which is the argument of Condillac, which was not shared by Descartes, of course, who believed that everything in our mind was innate. So Diderot raised the Molineux problem that was discussed by John Locke, I already mentioned. If a man born blind can feel the differences between shapes such as spheres and cubes, could he similarly distinguish those objects by sight if given the ability to see? And this is, of course, a very interesting question. And the answer by Locke, who was a radical empiricist, was no. Visual learning is absolutely necessary for the blind who would recover sight to recognize the difference between spheres and cube. But Diderot was more nuanced, and this is one part of the debate he suggests in his letter on the blind, and he introduced the issue of tactile learning, that in fact the blind was an expert, of course not in seeing, but in touch, and even better than those who have vision, and that in addition he was able to reason, and for him the answer to the Molyneux problem was very much nuanced compared to that of Locke. And he took the opportunity of the operation of cataract on a born blind to debate these issues. And these are illustration of the operation of cataract, which was performed at that time, and the attempt to debate with a blind person, the blind of Puiseux, who had been operated and who was interviewed by Diderot. And the answer that Diderot gained was that perhaps there were several aspects to answer this problem, and that if the blind who had recovered sight was not immediately able to, let's say, identify a sphere from a cube, he would nevertheless have some elements to bring this answer without necessarily have a full experience of it. So this was one of the aspects which, of course, are important in Diderot's views, that he had, in fact, a more nuanced position, that we had, in fact, both innate disposition and learned disposition, which is actually a view that which is accepted by most neurobiologists today. Yet, the answer to Molyneux's problem is not fully given by even today. And this is, of course, raising a very interesting question. Now, Diderot went further, and he presented a theory of variation of natural selection, which, to my view and those of those who have been concerned by this issue, anticipate to some extent Darwin. And in fact, he imagined a scene where a dying blind English mathematician, Nicolas Saunderson, that you see on the left, dreams about himself, about how it happened that he was blind, even though he was an outstanding mathematician, and about our origin and in imaginary dream that Diderot writes. I suggest you read the paper because I think it's remarkable, well written. Diderot gave in the mouth of Saunderson some views about the self-generation and variation of species and the importance of monsters which may happen, and in fact anticipate the evolution. And of course he discards the argument from design and even evokes the notion of thinking matter, which is an extraordinary, revolutionary view already in the 18th century. Of course, he was condemned by the church and by the political authorities, and he was, as you shall see, put in jail. Now, I illustrated this idea of Diderot with some drawing by, again, a woman artist, Madeleine Basseport, on the study of mammoth fossil teeth, which were brought from Louisiana, from the United States, in 1746, to the King of France, and also with the occurrence of monsters, if I may say, with the description of anencephaly by Pinson at the end of the 18th century, and which is here reproduced in wax. So these views of Diderot were really and are still ahead of his time. And as I said, he was in prison at Vincennes for 3 months. So at that time, it was not recommended to have ideas which were too revolutionary. And fortunately, he had some friends, and Voltaire, and again, Émilie du Châtelet, defended him, and he was finally released from the Vincennes prison. So this illustrates the difficulty one had at that time to have original ideas, but nevertheless, these ideas of Diderot became extremely popular. And as in the case of Newton, not only were there some theoretical arguments and views of philosophical importance about science, but also practical ones. And in this letter on the blind, the implications are very important that, in fact, as I said, the blinds may have a sense of tactile sense even more developed than persons having sight. And he was very much concerned himself and his followers, like Valentin Haüy, who read, of course, Diderot, by the education of the blind. And he invented the tactile reading method, Valentin Haüy, which with raised letters, which are analogic, as you can see here. And he also created the first school for the blind in Paris before the turn of the century. So these ideas of Diderot had a very important practical importance at the social level. You can see already the social implication of science and the ethical aspects of it. And another follower of Valentin Haüy, Louis Braille, who actually was a student at the National Institute for the Blind, which was created by Valentin Haüy, in fact invented, through a discussion with a military person, surprisingly, a writing method which seeks raised dots, position of cell. It's again digital compared to the analogic method that you saw before. And this is still method of writing and reading, which is used by the blind throughout the world. So we can see Diderot as being, of course, indirectly at the origin of this important method of education of handicapped children. Now, let's move to another interesting and important aspect of the philosophy of Enlightenment, which deal with moral judgment. And here, I will say a few words about the voyage of Bougainville. And before, again, I'm sorry to repeat myself, a very interesting woman artist, Anne Vallière-Coster, which shows the interest for exotic objects and animals, shells, stones, and natural sciences in general. And Louis-Antoine de Bougainville was, at the age of 25, inspired by Newton's Principia Mathematica. And not only he was inspired, but he published a treatise on the integral calculus, which was directly connected with Newton's Principia. So this illustrates again the importance of Newton's work, ideas, and thinking on the French Enlightenment. In 1755, he's secretary to the French Embassy in London and became, because of this book, member of the Royal Society. Then he shifted into military activities and was officer in the Seven Years' War against Britain with Montcalm in Canada and defeated. And this was for him a very sad moment, since he could not be on ship, but decided to make a more peaceful enterprise, and I think we should thank him for this evolution. And he started, made a plan to circumnavigate the globe in 1766, so he left Nantes, and with two ships, and this was before Cook, if I may say, La Boudeuse and L'Étoile, and he had in his boat botanist Philibert de Commerson, who was a very distinguished scientist and who described many species throughout the trip. And he visits the island of Tahiti in March 1767, and in 69 returned safely to France with very few people lost. And this is at variance with Cook, who had a lot of losses, and himself actually was killed during his last trip. So he was a really strong personality of the Enlightenment. And this is the frigate with 24 cannons, with the similar dimension of the ship used by Bougainville to circumnavigate the globe. And this is a testimony of the discovery of Tahiti, that he felt he had discovered. In fact, there was an English ship before him a few years before who had in fact made a discovery, but he was believing that he was discovering this new citerra, la nouvelle citerre. And you can see here the two ships and a very simplified landscape of Tahiti. Now they explored the nature, and we have still at the Museum National d'Histoire Naturelle the documents from the expedition of Bougainville, and plants, of course, I will show some of them, but also fishes which were dried and preserved like plants, and you see here one of them. Now there were a lot of plants which were described throughout this trip, and here in particular the hortensia, which was dedicated to Mrs. Le Pote, this famous astronomer I mentioned before. And here drawings, which were part of many of them, which are still in the collection of the Museum d'Histoire Naturelle, by Jossigny, about palm trees in the Bourbon Islands. Now, they had the opportunity, of course, to discover a new civilization in Tahiti and to realize that they have very different moral conventions. And these are some of the documents which were written by Philibert de Commerson in his notebook. And from all these observations that Bougainville did, he publishes The Voyage Autour du Monde, Trip Around the World, with a vision of an earthly paradise in Tahiti, where men and women live happily in innocence away from the corruption of Western civilization, illustrating the concept of the noble savage. So this book had an enormous influence at that time, and we may see here an extension again of Newton's philosophy. As I said, Bougainville had been early in his life a reader of Newton, and the extension of the approach, or the scientific approach, to issue about human societies, civilization, and of course moral conventions. Now, after this trip, Bougainville came back to the Navy. And actually, he had an interesting relationship with the United States, since in 1779-82, he was naval commander during the American War of Independence of the French fleet. And he was even the van flag in the defeat of the British fleet of the Chesapeake Battle, which was critical in the history of the United States. So this, again, is to illustrate through paintings by William Hodge, who was in the ship of Cook. Now, this is not from Bougainville. A description of these war boats of the natives from Tahiti. And, of course, Diderot was moved by the voyage of Bougainville and could not resist to write something about it. And he reacted to the book of Bougainville by writing an imaginary dialogue between philosopher, priest, and Western personalities with some of the native Tahitians. Again, it's a wonderful book to read, where he criticized heavily, I would say in rational Newtonian terms, the values and organization of Western society, slavery, colonization, religion, moral conventions, and so on and so forth. And the interesting aspect of it, which is again, to my view, an extension of the Newtonian philosophy, that the origin of morality is the concrete pursuit of happiness. Actually, when you read the Declaration of Independence, you find the same words. And the actual needs of the society, which has to be fulfilled by morality. So this is a secularization of ethics, which is suggested by Diderot here at the end of his life. Now, you may remember also here the sculpture, who is Jean-Antoine Houdon, and I will say a few words at the end, very end of my presentation in a few minutes. Now, this is to illustrate this evolution in the understanding of non-Western societies. This beautiful painting by Joseph Wright of Derby, who is a British painting artist, the widow of an Indian chief watching the arms of her deceased husband, which in fact is an illustration supposedly of America. Now, the last section, Benjamin Franklin and Henri Grégoire, the Declaration of Independence and the Rights of Man. He is a very attractive portrait of Benjamin Franklin by a French painter, Joseph Duplessis, which is at the National Portrait Gallery, and was painted at the time for Benjamin Franklin, and not shown, unfortunately, in Nancy. And one may recall, I am not going to say that in the American public, but perhaps to refresh your memory, that he was a printer, a newspaper editor, and merchant in Philadelphia, but also a prodigious inventor. He invented the lightning rod, the glass harmonica, the bifocal glasses, the flexible urinary catheter, among many other important discoveries. Point to mention, deliberately, Franklin never patented his inventions. He said, I quote, "We should be glad of an opportunity to serve others by any invention, any invention of ours, and this we should do freely and generously." I think this is a lesson for all of us. And according to him, scientific works had to be used for increasing efficiency and human improvement. Now, he was, of course, an exceptional scientist through his investigation of electricity. I'm not going to discuss that with you. And also, as a young man, he adopted the Enlightenment ideas and stated that, according to him, I quote, "God's truth can be found entirely through nature and reason." And this was written in a pamphlet in 1725, a dissertation on liberty and necessity, pleasure and pain. Now, Benjamin Franklin, in addition, had an important impact in the educated society in the United States. He created a library company of Philadelphia, where people could read. In 1743, he creates the American Philosophical Society, which is the first academy in the United States in Philadelphia. And he had, among others, as foreign correspondent, the French naturalist Buffon and the philosopher and mathematician Condorcet, among others. And the American readers became aware of the bestsellers of enlightened Europe, such as Montesquieu, Spirits of the Laws, and many other books which were published in Europe and in particular in France. And very interestingly, Franklin joins Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Sherman Livingstone, to become the first draft committee of the Declaration of Independence of 1776. After the declaration, he became ambassador to France. And he stayed there from 1776 to 1785. And he was very important in the relationship between the United States and France, since he negotiated a military alliance in 1778 and the Treaties of Paris in 1783. Now, an interesting aspect of the life of Benjamin Franklin in Paris is that he became the Grand Master of a lodge, which was a Masonic lodge, which became well famous, very famous, the Neuf Sœurs, the Nine Sisters, from 1779 until 1781. It is important to realize that he was the Grand Master, even being a foreigner, in this French lodge. And the lodge was opened in 1776 by the astronomer, and you remember I mentioned him about the comet of Halley, Jérôme de Lalande. Voltaire, you remember him, became a member. And I mentioned also the sculptor, Jean-Antoine Houdon, and also the painter, Jean-Baptiste Greuze. So there is really here a collection of scientists, artists, and humanists who discussed together within this lodge of the Neuf Sœurs. And very interestingly, Thomas Jefferson followed, take the job of Benjamin Franklin when he left, and John Adams was also a close friend of Thomas Jefferson in Paris. So there is really a link here between French Enlightenment and the Declaration of Independence, and Benjamin Franklin was also, of course, a co-signatory with Jefferson, Adams, and others of the Bill of Rights of 1789. Now, documentation about Benjamin Franklin. This very interesting picture of Benjamin Franklin, it's a print, in fact, by Marguerite Gérard, again a woman painter, to the genius of Franklin. And you can recognize here the goddess Athena, here America, Benjamin Franklin, Mars, tyranny, and England here losing the crown. Now, this is the end of what I am going to say with about Benjamin Franklin, and I will close my presentation with a French interesting figure of the French Revolution, Henri Grégoire. You have here a painting by Pierre-Joseph Célestin François. And I may say that he could be confronted with Benjamin Franklin in many respects on the French side. And he was a French Catholic priest, constitutional bishop of Blois, and in addition, ardent Republican and revolutionary leader. He writes in 1788 an essay on the physical and moral regenerations of the Jews to protect the Jews in France. In 1789, he contributes to the writing of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, propose at a national convention that men of color have the same rights as whites, and propose the citizenship to Jews. In 1792, he proposed the abolition of monarchy, together with Robespierre, who was his close friend, at the National Convention. Then, in 1794, he proposed several extremely important motions. First, the abolition of slavery, with a positive vote of the French Convention in 1794. A motion for the restraining the vandalism, the destruction of cultural objects, the reorganization of public libraries, the establishment of botanical gardens, the improvement of scientific and technical education, and the creation of the Conservatory of Conservatoire des Arts et Métiers for Art and Crafts, which is for the scientific and technical education for those who during the day are practicing a job to get their living, and in the night are going to work to further learn and progress in their scientific and technical knowledge. And he was buried in 1989 in the Pantheon, but never recognized by the Catholic Church. And I may say he's an icon of what could be called a secular universalism. And here I illustrate some of the action of Henri Grégoire, cultural objects from the Jewish community in France in the 18th century, and his book on the Jews. Here, very interesting print, which of course has a lot of symbolic significance, the equality granted to the blacks, and which states that the mortals are equal. It is not the birth, but only the virtue that makes the difference. And you can recognize here these demons which are living, which is aristocracy, the life for oneself, and injustice. And here you may recognize nature with all these breasts here, together with equality, to state that the white and the blacks are equal. This is a very interesting illustration of Henri Grégoire and others' attempt to give freedom to the blacks. And here a picture of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen of 1789. And of course, the three key words of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which are liberty, equality, and I think I may say the third one, which is fraternity, which is unfortunately often forgotten. Now, this is not the very end, because I wanted to illustrate for Henri Grégoire the emphasis on scientific education with the creation of this Conservatory of Art and Craft. And here, one of the Vaucanson drawings, where he collected machines and drawings to educate the young about science and techniques. And as I said, this is not the last slide, since I think this relationship between France and United States continued. And here you can recognize René Cassin and Eleanor Roosevelt, who were the main writers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. So, with you, I went through this uncharted path from Newton to the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And after all, from the application of Newton's mode of thinking about science, the emergence of universal, and I emphasize the word universal, ethical values. And I may close by stating Condorcet. Americans were a people of philosophers who had first turned the dreams of the Enlightenment into realities. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.